Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
A couple weeks back, we talked with Corey Olson about spiritual themes in the writings of J.R.R. Tolkien, with particular attention to The Hobbit, since that mirth-filled adventure tale is coming soon to theaters near you. That discussion got me thinking not only about the spiritual aspects of The Hobbit, but about religion in Hollywood more generally. One of the most successful movies of all time was Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ, released in 2004. What was astounding about that movie was not only its $600 million box office gross, but that it was filmed mostly in a language that nobody on the planet speaks anymore, Aramaic. And who in their right mind would go see a movie in a dead language you couldn't understand? Well, millions upon millions of people did. Add to this the success of other spiritually laced films such as Fireproof and The Blind Side, and it's hard to deny that there is a huge market for films that take religion seriously. And yet, it seems that all those other movies that have been released over the past several decades don't necessarily show religious figures or institutions in a favorable light. Indeed, clergy are often portrayed as corrupt, evangelical Christians frequently appear as illiterate hypocrites, and religious institutions come across as nothing more than places where greed and malevolent conspiracies run rampant. Granted, history has shown us a fair share of despicable behavior in the name of God, but to many of us in the religious community, it just seems as if the creative forces of Hollywood never give us a fair shake. Maybe this is just good movie making, turning the good into bad so as to capture our attention. Or perhaps us religious folks are just being overly sensitive on the whole subject. Well, to help me figure out all of this, who better to turn to than somebody who has made his living, among other things, as being a movie critic for over three decades? I'm very pleased today to have with me Michael Medved, the self-proclaimed cultural crusader who hosts a talk radio show that reaches more than 4 million listeners daily. That's just a handful more than all of you folks who are regular subscribers to Research on Religion. Michael is also the author of several books, including What Really Happened to the Class of 65, which was turned into a television miniseries, Hollywood vs. America, The 50 Worst Films of All Time, and The 10 Big Lies About America, to name just a few of his many works. We'll link to all those books on our website, so please check them out. And don't forget, we are on Facebook, so stop by and like us so that we can return the love. Michael, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. What a pleasure and what a nice introduction.
I'm curious. You wrote the 50 worst films of all time. So what is the worst movie of all time?
Well, when we did the 50 worst films, I mean, there's a long story about that. And I tell that story in my book. Notice I'm promoting another book called Right Turns, which is a story about how I went from being a punk liberal activist to becoming a lovable conservative curmudgeon. And I did the 50 worst films with my brother, Harry, who's much younger than I was. He was 15 at the time that we did this book, and it was one of those things where I had already gotten two book contracts. I was trying desperately to avoid going back to law school, which I didn't want to do. And so basically, my parents, who were important in my life, I mean, both my parents are gone now. My parents thought that I should get three book contracts because they had heard you can't make a living as a writer. Nobody can make a living as a writer. And they didn't want to have a useless oldest son setting the bad example for his three younger brothers. So basically what happened with that book is it was an afterthought. I didn't even know that much about movies. It was just I had a little brother who was a movie freak.
Yeah, as a teenage kid, this is your fantasy to write a book about the worst movies you've seen.
Well, no one had done it before, and we had laughed together. There was a book we had at home called by Bosley Crowther called The 50 Greatest Films of All Time. And Bosley Crowther, a longtime movie critic for The New York Times, And so basically, I had sent to my agent, I had sent around all these ideas for books, and two of them came back, and one became The Shadow Presidents, and one became What Really Happened to the Class of 65. And one of the ideas that I sent out was, I didn't even list some movies. I said, Jay, we want to do a book on the 50 worst films of all time. And Popular Library Press bought it. And then we had to do it. And the interesting thing was, we're talking about 1978 is when that book came out. So there was no video. And it was really difficult to research. And we had to go to film archives. And it was just ended up being... So we did not at that point come up with what we did do to avoid... the absence of having one worst film of all time. I mean, we had all kinds of strange films in the 50 worst films of all time, but it really wasn't such a prodigious work of research. It was just sort of catch as catch can. But we did a suggestion where readers could write in, and we actually got several thousand responses from readers because a book became successful. And so we collated them, and for the next book, we which was the Golden Turkey Awards, we did an award based upon the votes of readers, and it was for Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Ah, yes, the old Ed Wood film.
Correct. Now, yeah. This is at a time no one had ever heard of Ed Wood, no one had heard of that film. Remember, it's pre-video, and we actually... ended up providing the inspiration for that Tim Burton movie. The way I know that is because we had mistakes in this was the first ever printed biography of Ed Wood, was in Golden Turkey Awards. And we had made mistakes about Ed. I mean, we'd been told things that weren't true, and that made it into the movie. they stole it. They stole the mistakes right directly from our book.
Yeah. So Plan 9 from Outer Space is the worst movie of all time. I could see that.
By the way, begun in 1959, and then they shut down production after Bela Lugosi died.
Yeah.
And then resumed production in 1963 using some of the footage of the dead Bela Lugosi and having his chiropractor, the director's chiropractor, stand in for Bela Lugosi. His name was Dr. Tom Mason, and he looked nothing like Lugosi. I mean, he just did it with a cloak drawn over his face to hide the lack of resemblance.
Yeah, no, that was a great film. I actually did see that one. So I got to ask, if we got that as the worst film of all time, what is the best movie of all time? Please say Die Hard. Please say Die Hard.
Well, I guess what they call the fans of the Twilight series Twihards. But I'm not such a fan of either the Die Hard or the Twilight series. But it's one of those things where it's tough when you do this for many years to come up with a list of the 10 best movies of the year, let alone 10 best of all time. Yeah. But out of self-defense, usually when I'm asked my favorite movies of all time, not necessarily the greatest, I have a double answer. One is Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, a Frank Capra 1939 classic, and the other is Elia Kazan's first major film, which is called A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, which is just a wonderful father-daughter movie, which is why I'm so partial to it.
Okay. Well, enough about this silly chat about which movies are best and worst. I'm really here to figure out what's wrong with Hollywood, if anything.
We don't have enough time.
Oh, we don't have enough time. So there must be something wrong with Hollywood. So I'm on the right track here. And I want to focus on how Hollywood portrays religion and religious people fairly. But first, I want to get a little bit about your own background and your basis for giving us this analysis. So I have two general questions here. The first is, how did you become a movie critic? And second, what is your religious background? Let's start with that first question of how does one get to be a movie critic? Sounds like the world's best job other than being the taste tester at Guinness Brewery. did this come out of the book that you wrote?
It did, actually. And what happened is after 50 Worst Films, we got a good deal of publicity for that book, even though we literally had thrown it together. And as I said, and then we did Golden Turkey Awards, which was an international bestseller. And I was on CNN. CNN had just started in 1980. And I was on CNN three different times promoting our book. And that, I thought, you know, that's great. As you know, when you're an author, any kind of TV attention is considered to be solid gold. You love it. You're grateful for it. And so after I was on CNN the third time, The producer of the segment on CNN that I was on was a guy named Eddie Madison. They had an entertainment segment 1 hour a day that they used to do. He said, "Why don't you come back next week and you can review movies for us?" And I thought, "Oh, great! I'll get to promote my book some more." No, they were offering me a job, and it wasn't much of a job in terms of payment, but it was something. And so that's basically it. I mean, I had never been, as I mentioned, I had never been particularly. I was always interested in movies. I used to go to. I never ran the Yale Film Society when I was in college, but all of a sudden, I had this job where once a week I was supposed to come in and basically report on all the new movies. Now, I didn't understand at the beginning that doing that on a major cable network, I could actually get free admission to movies. I still, for the first year, I was still paying for tickets.
Oh, really?
Just asinine. I mean, so stupid. I was such a child.
I was going to ask, though, if, you know, once you get onto something like CNN and you're reviewing movies, do theaters start wooing you? Obviously, they want you to come see the movie for free, but do you get people saying, "Oh, you really want to see this movie? It's really good."
Well, yeah, now, of course, but it took a while. Okay. And I'm sort of at the end of the CNN period, I was on the. And then there are the various critics organizations, some of which I literally was blackballed from because I'm conservative and a right winger and a critic of Hollywood. But in any event, and after CNN, I actually got a job on British TV and did that for a year on Channel 4 in Great Britain. And that was great fun. Did a special show called The Worst of Hollywood. And then after that, got sneak previews on PBS for 12 years. So basically, it was not, I never, ever, ever in my life took a film course. In terms of what I know about movies, I'm an autodidact. I've begun, I think, to master. But the main advantage that any critic has, and it's the only advantage, is not the film courses he's taken or how much. The main advantage is just a sense of context and perspective, because most people don't see many movies. They will go out and see Life of Pi, and, "Oh, that's the greatest movie I ever saw." Well, you haven't seen many movies, buddy. I mean, the fact is that when you do this over a period of time and you end up, when I was chief film critic for the New York Post, at the Post, I was reviewing 250 movies a year.
Wow.
It's a lot of films.
A movie a day.
Yeah. And weekdays, yeah. And there would be some three screening nights. So now, because my main focus in life is, of course, the daily radio show for 3 hours a day, which is mostly about politics, almost entirely about politics, I'm down. I usually do about probably 100 movies a year. So
that's still a lot.
Two a week.
Yeah,
it's still a lot more than the normal American will watch. It averages out to less than three movies a year. And there are a third of Americans who don't go at all.
Well, here's a question I have, and this connects with our theme of, does Hollywood get the average person, the average churchgoer, the person who's out there in middle America, is that whenever I hear movie theater or movie critics, they always are dogging on the movies that I love. Right. The Avengers and Die Hard. Those are the kind of things that I love. And the movies that they give the highest ratings to and that eventually end up going to the Academy Awards are just bore me to tears. Is there a movie critic culture that they, you know, movie critics somehow get self-contained in and they're reviewing movies for one another rather than reviewing movies for the general populace?
Well, sure. And it's not only reviewing movies, it's making movies for one another. And that's something that most people don't understand, is during the time that I was at PBS and the 12 years I was at PBS doing sneak previews, I've often said were two of the happiest weeks of my life. but it was during the middle of that period, because there it was just basically doing a weekly show and reviewing, that was five movies every single week, and sometimes more because you'd also want to be in touch with the video releases. And it was just overwhelmingly obvious that the caliber of work was awful. And one of the things that actually got me onto this issue initially was There was a movie called Agnes of God. I don't know if you remember it. Yeah. It was an awful movie with Jane Fonda. And I think it was Jane Fonda and one of the Tillys. I think it was Meg Tilly. But I said something about the film, and I said, boy, this is really very different. It's a film about nuns. And it starts out with a nun murdering her own baby that she delivers, trying to keep it a secret in the convent, and it's all this nightmarish stuff, and it's the most nightmarish vision of the Catholic Church you can imagine. It's just about as negative as it could possibly be. Anne Bancroft is in the movie too, and I made a comment on the air. I said, you know, I used to really enjoy all the old wonderful Catholic movies where priests were lovable and kind and wise and played by Bing Crosby, usually. Mm-hmm. But you know, Bells of St. Mary's was wonderful. These were Going My Way, if you remember that film. And even in On the Waterfront, you may remember there's a compassionate priest, and that was kind of a standard. So what happened where basically every vision you have of I made a comment like that on the air and about the fact that the Catholic Church was such a big target, and I got a letter from a bishop who actually later became a cardinal, and just saying it was so refreshing to hear that, and this is something that concerns us, and I began correspondence with him, and it just became obvious to me that there was a huge chunk of the audience that was being dissed and ignored on this issue of religion.
Mm-hmm.
I did a special on PBS called Hollywood versus Religion, and then that helped spin off into my book, Hollywood versus America, because it's not just the trashing of clerics. It's not just the trashing of religious believers is either crazy or corrupt or very often both. It's also the blind spot for what is, after all, a huge factor in American life. 42% of voters, according to exit polls, went to church or synagogue once a week or more. That's once a week. 55% of voters went to church or synagogue once a month or more. Now, that's a majority. On any given week, five times as many people go to church as go to the movies.
Yeah, and that's definitely something to put in perspective.
Yeah, and the fact that this no one pays any attention to this, that and you're right, there has been, I mean, it's something I've been writing and talking about now for a quarter century. And I think to some extent it's gotten better. I was one of the very few people who defended Mel Gibson on The Passion of the Christ. I was delighted to see that the film did as well as it did. I thought it was spectacular as a piece of filmmaking, and I know I did not think it was anti-Semitic, and I think that entire thing was ginned up by a lot of people who hadn't seen the movie, which is awful. I mean, I think it's awful when people condemn anything that they haven't seen.
That goes to the culture of the critics, right? The critics were already criticizing this movie even before anybody had seen a two-minute clip of it.
Yeah, and it was basically because they... there was a New York Times story before the film's release about Mel's father, unusual guy. He has 10 sons, 10 children, and he's an unusual guy. He certainly has some terrible ideas. He's a Holocaust denier, and he's a bad guy. That doesn't mean that Mel is a bad guy. Mel is a troubled guy, as the whole world has come to know. But he put his life and soul and heart into this movie, and I think he made something that was indelible. And one of the things, I was involved in so many of these debates, and again, you talk about the culture of the critics. One of the things about the culture of critics, a couple of things. One is that when you see a lot of movies and you kind of have to pry open your eyelids with toothpicks to stay awake during some of the films, the one thing that you value almost above anything else is novelty. Something that's different. Oh, I've never seen that before. Now, you'd think that a movie made entirely in Aramaic might fill the bill. But there is generally an identification that affirming religion is something bourgeois, and it's something that you're not supposed to do. And generally, Same idea about sexuality. I mean, there was a, this is, goes over the TV industry, but there was a study that was done, and was done, oh, more than 10 years ago, but I don't think it's changed for the better, where they talked about instances of intercourse that was either implied or shown or some way dramatized in TV shows. And intercourse was 14 times more common outside of marriage than between married couples, which is not reality, by the way. Yeah. I mean, married couples at every age group have more sex than single people do, which, again, people get the completely wrong idea because of film. So it's one of those things where I do think that to some extent the entire industry is based upon trying to win respect of peers. And that's not just critics, it's filmmakers as well. You could ask, why do they keep making these movies attacking religious faith, some of them quite prominent, some of them quite vicious? There was a film made by Harvey Weinstein called The Pope Must Die, which was a supposed comedy starring Robbie Coltrane. And then they got such big bad blowback from the film that they retitled it The Pope Must Diet. But it, you know, original, I mean, they still refer to The Pope Must Die in the film. This kind of thing, this was when John Paul was still alive, and it's one of those things where they don't make these movies because they think they're going to make money. There is, I mean, I have a list in my book, I've even compiled more recent lists of films that just flop miserably. Right now they're talking about Broadway shows that flop miserably because they try to dramatize. They have a new one which premiered here in Seattle. Premiered in Seattle as Saving Amy. They're calling it Scandalous, and it's about Amy Semple McPherson. And portrays her as a wayward sex bond, et cetera, et cetera. And, but see, they've have so many of these Broadway shows and so many of these musicals and so many of these movies that will take religious figures and trash them. The only one that succeeded at all is the Book of Mormon. And that's basically because it's affectionate, and also because, well Mormons are... attacking Mormons or characterizing Mormonism as strange is not the same as doing that for Christianity in general, which still represents about over 80% of Americans who identify themselves as Christian. In the recent election, 78% of all voters said they were either Protestant or Catholic. And if you add people who said, I'm just plain Christian and wouldn't identify Protestant, it's up to 85%.
Right. Well, I want to explore why Hollywood trashes religion so much and why they're not doing anything, or if something is being done about it now. But I want to hold back on that. I want to still explore the issue of your role as a movie critic. And you say you had affection for Catholic movies, but you're not Catholic. Your religious background is Jewish. Liz, tell us a little bit about your religious background.
Well, sure. In short, I mean, again, this is something that I write about in my book, Right Turns, extensively. But I did not grow up in a particularly religious household, though my parents were very proud to be Jewish, and they had very strong Jewish feelings. But starting in my late teens and then through my early 20s, I became increasingly religious. I've been a Sabbath observer since I was 23, and which, of course, makes it really tough sometimes in the movie world because that's no screenings or movie stuff on Friday nights or Saturday during the day. One of the awful things about Seattle is they show all the family movies that you're supposed to see in advance. They have the critics' screenings for the family movies on Saturday morning. And, of course, I'm left out from that. But I would certainly say that my own transition to being very involved in Jewish religious life, and I was president of a synagogue for 15 years, that is certainly enhanced my sensitivity to this issue and my commitment to maybe trying to at least get people in the industry to understand that it was a stupid financial bet, regardless of whether you think it's offensive or not. It's just a stupid financial bet to spend a lot of money to try to offend religious sensibilities. And I can answer why very quickly. The sense of artistry that you have in Hollywood has to do with shock value. And it's the same problem with modernism in so many fields of art. I was reading today, there's a story, and I was meaning to do it on the air. Maybe I'll get to it tomorrow or Friday. But there was a story about this Robert Rauschenberg painting that they are, it's a collage, it's an assemblage, and it's valued at $67 million, but they can't sell it at all because it has a dead bald eagle fastened to it. This is, and that's violation of federal law. And so this is a little side note, but I love this story, Tony, because they're not allowed to sell this painting, so it was officially valued, assessed at zero, the value. So when the owner of the painting died and left it to his children, the IRS assessed them for $67 million and for the death tax, and they had to pay was $28, $29 million, which they didn't have. And they said, well, okay, sell the painting. Said, we can't sell the painting. We're not allowed to sell the painting. The only thing they could do to escape taxes was to donate it. And that's the only way they could get out of paying $29 million for a painting they're not allowed to sell.
Yeah,
but okay.
It's a story that's familiar with farmers, by the way, in the estate tax. So, yeah.
But the idea of high art, something being worth $67 million that features a bald eagle carcass, that's the same thing with movies. Something that is shocking is always considered to be worthy of particular attention. I'll tell you what my everyone's taste in movies is different, but a significant year for Hollywood was the year, I think it was the films that had been released in 91, when they gave the Oscar and for best actor, best actress, best picture, best director, everything to Silence of the Lambs, which I thought was just wildly, wildly overrated. It was a well-done thriller, but so what? It's not a best picture. And it had beaten A Beauty and the Beast, which I actually think is a classic and one of the best animated movies ever made. It's a work of genius. I mean, every frame of that film holds up. I happen to love animated films in general, but that one in particular. And the idea that that film was nominated for Best Picture, didn't get it, that they chose Silence of the Lambs. I'm very sure people will still be watching Beauty and the Beast when they've forgotten all about Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. Back to your religious background, though, and as a movie critic, you often might think of yourself as a journalist and you have to come in with objectivity, and you might want to leave your religious values at the door. Is that how you approach what you do as a movie critic, or do you take your Orthodox Jewish background into the theaters with you and see the world through those eyes?
No, I try to. I mean, I understand that only a tiny portion of my audience would share my religious perspective or even my general religious perspective. So I don't. It's one of those things where I think it's important to talk about the messages that a movie sends, and I think that my religious background makes me particularly sensitive to that. There's a saying in Jewish scripture that life and death is in the tongue. That what you say, what you communicate, is profoundly important and profoundly potent. So that does inform me on my daily radio show and informs me in my movie work, but and also makes me very sensitive to trying to look at, okay, what is this movie trying to say? What's it trying to communicate? How's it trying to impact people? But I think that's very separate from talking about the quality of a film as a work of art. For instance, I've been criticized in the past. I'm trying to think of a good example because there are many. It happens all the time. Well, I will recommend an R-rated movie. I'll give you an example. I recently recommended one of the best movies I've seen this year is called Silver Linings Playbook. And it has lots of harsh language, and it has two characters played by Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence, who both of whom are broken people in some ways, and it shows all kinds of bad human behavior. It was a very compassionate, very wonderful movie, and I think ultimately very affirming. But would I recommend that to people that I knew who were strictly Orthodox, who wanted, for instance, not to see a film that had references, graphic references to sexuality and scenes of partial nudity. No, of course not. But you see, that's part of what I do in reviews, is I will tell people that that's there, so they will be forewarned. But no, I don't feel that there is a purity test that a movie has to pass in order to be recommended. By the way, those purity tests, there's an awful lot of Shakespeare that wouldn't make it either. I mean, people who object to violence in movies, my wife does, but she's consistently, she won't see a movie with violence at all. She just won't. She wouldn't see Lincoln, which I think is a great film.
I hear that ends violently.
Yeah. They don't show it.
Oh, they don't. Okay. No. Don't spoil it for our listeners.
Yeah, I think people know how it works out.
Okay.
But it's not well for the country. But the point about that film is it begins with about 90 seconds of really horrific violence, showing a very realistic recreation of the kind of hand-to-hand combat, incredibly brutal combat that people had to go through in the War for the Union. And that's enough to take my wife off that film. And I think that the job of a responsible critic is not to say, well, I can't recommend this film because it has violence in it, but to say, I recommend this film heartily, but you should be prepared for violence. I loved Saving Private Ryan. I'd say that's one of the great movies ever made. And that's a film, obviously, just filled with violence, filled with harsh language. And that would be an example. I know some of my religious listeners, how can you be so enthusiastic about a film like that? Well, that's I think that you have to judge the content of a film and its artistic success. Basically, what I try to bring to it is trying to determine what it is that a film is trying to achieve. And your job as a reviewer or critic is to determine to what extent it succeeds in its own terms. And its own terms may not be your terms.
Yeah, and that's probably a difficult thing to do in many respects. I know a number of my evangelical friends look to your movie reviews because they know you're a deeply religious person, and so they respect that. So, you know, even though you're Orthodox Jewish, we're evangelical Christian, they say, well, that guy kind of has our ideas in mind. And you do review some movies that we say sometimes, like, I don't know if we want our kids seeing that. But again, you provide warnings for that. One of the other things that's happened recently, too, with the spread of the internet is that there's been a number of different religious movie reviewers who do it on their own. The Movie Mom, and there's a number of different websites like that. As everybody's becoming a critic now, and so that.
Well, yeah. And that's it's an interesting thing as to what's happened in that field. I mean, I'm very grateful that I don't have to or even attempt to make my living as a movie critic anymore. And since doing the Daily Radio Show, which started in 1996, it's hard to believe. It creeps up on you as you're getting older, as you know. But what has happened is that there are so many people who just like doing it. And basically do it for free.
Right, yeah.
And so once upon a time, Ebert and Siskel, when they got their second contract for Ebert and Siskel and the Movies, which was the successor show to At the Movies, which was a successor show to Sneak Preview, which was the show that we took over and that I did for 12 years, when Ebert and Siskel at one point were getting $1 million a year each.
Wow.
To review movies. And no one, I mean, again, this has always been a kind of job that you do for love. But that then people had this idea that, man, this is a path to fortune, to fame maybe. But I think that Roger and Gene would be just about the only people ever who have really made a significant money doing reviewing movies. Pauline Kael certainly never did. I don't think the people who work for the New York Times now, A.O. Scott or Manola Dargis, do.
Hmm. Yeah, well, same thing here in the podcast business. You know, even though we're trying to put you talk show radio show out of host or host out of business, but yeah, we do it for the love and that. Let me talk about the general cultural climate of movies in Hollywood, and we've touched upon this already a little bit, but I want to press you on something that you wrote in your book, The 10 Big Lies About America. The 10th lie, or the myth that you seek to debunk is that the U.S. is in an irreversible moral decline. And my evangelical friends are always saying, oh, look at it. Everything's going bad. It's horrible. It's now, in that book, I agree with you a lot that we're the United States is not in an irreversible moral decline. You could just take a random dart and throw it at history and find anywhere in American history, you'll find somebody saying, oh, we're in an irreversible moral decline. That's a constant throughout history. You know, kids are never going to church. Why? Because kids never went to church. That's, you know, kind of a constant there. But nonetheless, movies have become a big part of our culture. And through my lifetime, and I grew up in the 60s, 70s, and up to today, I've seen what I think to be a coarsening of movie culture. And this happened somewhere around the late 60s, early 1970s, maybe with the Bonnie and Clyde and Easy Rider. The movies started changing. There were anti-heroes, and the things that used to be heroic are no longer.
It wasn't gradual. It was sudden. It was sudden, and it was deliberate, and it was organizational in this sense. The production code was initiated in 1930. And it was known as the Hays Code because Harding's former Postmaster General Will Hays had been brought out to Hollywood to put in the production code. And the reason they put in the production code was because there were so many protests from the so-called pre-code movies in the late 20s, early talkies, really challenged a lot of sensibilities at the time, mm-hmm. stuff that would be considered pretty sleazy and racy even today. So the code basically said, for instance, it was a rule by the code, you could not show two human beings in bed together. Yeah. It was just no. You were not allowed. Article 8 of the code, Rule 8 of the code, said you could not trash the any accepted, known, established religion or the clergy of that religion. If you were going to show a minister, priest, or rabbi, it had to be either positive or neutral. Could not be negative.
Bells of St. Mary type, yeah.
All right, you were not allowed to show that crime paid. Now, all of this, we would say, oh, isn't that awful? Well, but everyone agrees on one thing. The greatest year for movies ever was 1939, at the height of the code, where despite these restrictions, Hollywood made films like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Gone with the Wind, and Wizard of Oz, and Wuthering Heights, and John Ford's Young Mr. Lincoln, and Stagecoach same year, and so many other films that came out. So the idea that what happened was in 1966, the Motion Picture Producers Association of America brought in a new sheriff in town, Jack Valenti, who had been the press secretary to President Lyndon Johnson. And one of the first things that he did is he decided that he would drop the code because it was 1966 and people – and at the time they were very worried because what used to be called foreign films, which were mostly French films, were doing a big share of business. At one point they even reached 10% of the national box office, wow. which is a big deal. Today it's half of 1%. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's almost nothing. And the reason people are going to foreign films because you could see breasts, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And I remember at the time being a teenager at the time. I said, "Oh, you could see stuff in foreign movies that you couldn't see in American films." So they dropped the code, and they instituted this current rating system. And originally, they were just going to have two ratings. M for mature and G for general audiences. And Jack Valenti said, I am sure that we will never have more than 5% of all movies will be rated M.
Ha!
And of course, immediately when the code changed in 1966, and what you went from is in 1965, Best Picture of the Year was Sound of Music. In 1969, Best Picture of the Year was rated X, which was the new rating, was called Midnight Cowboy. And by the way, during that time period, the movie audience, those 4 years, when they all of a sudden, and you have Bonnie and Clyde, and you have The Wild Bunch, and you have all these groundbreaking films that are just so, people said the F word, because there was no limit anymore. There was no rules. And what happened is the movie audience evaporated. literally, the movie audience went down far more than it did at the onset of TV. They lost two-thirds of the weekly audience. Two-thirds.
That's fascinating. I didn't know that before.
And it hasn't gone up.
Wow.
And it hasn't gone up even in raw numbers, which is basically saying to middle America, F you.
Yeah. And let me ask about that, because growing up in the 70s, there didn't seem to be very many G-rated films.
No.
I mean, I remember, you know, in the late 60s, you could see some of the Disney classics, Flubber and the Shaggy D.A. Those were out and they were cute, the Love Bug. But then those just seemed to evaporate. And I can't remember growing up as a teen in the 70s. There was nothing to go see.
No, exactly right. And it's one of those things where this was a very, very big point in my book, Hollywood versus America, which came out in 1992. Mm-hmm. Which was how stupid this was, because I did something that no one had ever bothered to do before, which is to put in a bunch of numbers into a computer and to figure out, is it true what people in Hollywood assumed, which is you need to have that R rating, because without the R rating, you couldn't possibly get a big box office film. Now, you may remember with E.T. came out initially with a PG-13 rating. And it came out, why PG-13?
Wow, yeah, I didn't know that.
Because Drew Barrymore, who was 6 years old at the time, they have her say a nasty word. And do you remember what it was?
No.
It was a P word referring to a male sex organ, breath.
Yeah, okay.
She says, and it's just that got its P. But they needed that. They put that in deliberately because they were on the assumption that G-rated movies, no one wants to see them. Okay. So I did Hollywood vs. America. It turns out that G-rated movies outperformed R-rated movies by 3-1, which is not rocket science. I mean, look, if if you want to get more customers into a movie, maybe it makes sense to aim at more customers. And with an R-rated movie, you're basically restricting your access to that very substantial part of the movie audience below 18. So when my book came out, I mean, I was just ripped by Hollywood. Oh, Medved's crazy, and we can't all be Beauty and the Beast. And, but then there were a couple of academic studies, one at University of Hong Kong and then one at University of California, Irvine, and the one at University of California, Irvine was released under the heading, Michael Medved Was Right.
Yeah, right. That's cool to have a title in the academic journal. Yeah.
But again, then they looked at it and they looked at films all around the world. That's true all around the world. It's not just the United States. It's not just our prudish country. So that has changed, by the way. And now there are directors who have in their contracts, you have to avoid the R. Because the R is poison. I mean, it is, if you go through a list of the top grossing movies of all time, if you take the top 100, it's a tiny percentage of them are rated R. And even if you took since the rating system was initiated, the top grossing movies, a tiny percentage are rated R. There's virtually no year that you can think of where the top movie of the year is rated R.
Has there been a renaissance, though, since, I would say, the mid-1990s, maybe because of,
yes,
of your article? Because
animated films in particular.
Yeah,
because
the Pixar films are fantastic.
Right, I mean, and they all do fantastic, all except Brave. I hated Brave.
Didn't see Brave. My son is getting a little bit old for that now, but you know, I'm thinking Finding Nemo is one of my favorite films.
Oh, it's outstanding,
And it's nice because they figured out how to make an audience craft an audience that appeals to young kids, but also there's a lot of adult humor that's subtle in there. But
absolutely. The Toy Story trilogy is as successful and wonderful a trilogy as anyone's ever made. I mean, the third movie can move you to tears. It's just a deeply wonderful, wonderful filmmaking. Yes, there is a renaissance of that kind of filmmaking. And the other thing is, you mentioned The Blind Side before. The Blind Side made tons of money. I don't know what the final box office outcome was. What surprised me, frankly, is that with The Passion, I would have assumed that with The Passion of the Christ, making, I believe I spoke to Mel not too long ago, and I think they've gone over $1 billion in worldwide box office gross.
Yeah, once you start throwing in the videos and that. Yeah,
yeah, and they're going to do a re-release. I mean, Mel was joking and said a 3D version.
Oh, there you go. Yeah,
yeah, but no, it's one of those films where it was made for nothing. It was like $35 million, which is nothing in today's Hollywood. And it's one of those things. Wouldn't you think that they would go back to making a bunch of biblical films? In the 1950s, early 60s, there was one six-year period where the number one box office film every year was a biblical film. David and Bathsheba, Demetrius and the Gladiator, Ben-Hur, Ten Commandments.
Yeah, that's classic, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and it was like a license. And some, a lot of these movies are really bad. They were awful. And yet they made money because they're people who are eager to see it. And honestly, making a quality biblical pictures, there's so many great stories. It amazes me that nobody picked up on Gibson's lead. I mean, they tried to do it with Nativity Story,
right?
Which is directed by Catherine Hardwicke. But there's not that much drama in the Nativity Story. Sorry, I mean, you kind of know what's going to happen.
Right.
And, of course, you know what's going to happen in the Passion, too. But
yeah, you got to go to the Old Testament. That's where the action is.
Yeah, or with the New Testament, I think a good movie. The ministry of Jesus is just incredibly interesting. First of all, it really happened. And I think that increasingly even skeptics and atheists recognize that, yeah, there was this guy, and he did have just a handful of followers. And within a couple of generations, he ended up having millions of followers.
Right.
Now, how'd that happen? That's interesting.
Yeah, that would definitely make a good story. Now, I know that coming up in a few months or so, the Noah is coming out with Russell Crowe. Although I've heard previews of that it's going to be a global warming tale or something of that nature. So I don't know what will be happening. But I had the same thought, too, is that, you know, Mel Gibson's movie made boatloads of money. And so, you know, why wouldn't any movie producer worth their weight and salt say, wow, we could make lots of money, especially at times when video and other forms of entertainment are really kind of squeezing the bottom line. But it's is there movement in Hollywood, you see, to say, yeah,
oh, there is.
I mean, you got the G-rated movies, but what about religion? Is religion making a comeback?
Sure. And there are lots of organizations and individuals and ministries And this, by the way, cuts across all religious denominations. Mm-hmm. Hollywood is fairly famous for having been a largely a Jewish-created industry, the American movie industry. But there have never been, until very recently, any religious Jews in Hollywood. There are people who are proud to be Jewish and people who would support Wilshire Boulevard Temple, which was where the movie stars used to go. But they would only go for Yom Kippur. It was like people would only go for Christmas, mm-hmm. if you're Christian. But now there are a bunch of folks who are involved in the entertainment industry who are deeply religious, Jewish and Christian, and some of them in positions of authority and making a difference and even working together on things. And that's part of the secret between a lot of the movies that end up inspiring people. That movie Rudy, mm-hmm. which people love, was made deliberately by people who wanted to, some of the same people behind Hoosiers, who are trying to make a values-rich movie. And, mm-hmm. and look, the people who go into this business are not stupid. And I think sometimes the question becomes, why don't people get this message? And again, the answer is, by the time you're in a position in Hollywood where you can either green light a movie or red light a movie, you decide what gets made, you don't have to worry about where your next paycheck is coming from. You don't have to worry about your next Mercedes is coming from. It doesn't matter to you how much money the movie makes. What matters to you is, are my peers going to like it? Is it going to help me go to bed with beautiful women, which is a huge standard of success in Hollywood? And let's face it, somebody who makes the latest shocker about cannibalism, which is critically acclaimed, is probably going to have better luck with the dewy-eyed young starlets than somebody who makes an animated film about talking bears.
Yeah. What about another trend I've noticed.
That is, unless the animated film about talking bears is Ted, which is that awful film by Seth MacFarlane.
Yes.
About an obscene teddy bear.
Yeah.
Now, that by the way, that's one where, yes, I did review the film in terms of values because it was so specifically they were trying to get people, oh, yeah, look, there's this really cute talking teddy bear, and they don't tell you that there's a teddy bear who does cocaine with prostitutes.
And, yeah, they lure you in with, a traditional standard symbol of wholeness, and then they tear it apart, just like the movie Bad Santa.
Right.
And a few others like that. One of the other trends I've noticed that might be inspiring for a lot of religious-oriented people is the fact that the cost of movies, even though the big blockbusters are becoming more and more expensive, but just to make a normal movie, the cost is coming down. It's a much more accessible. You just think about YouTube. 15-year-olds can do pretty good movies on YouTube. But there's a group of folks, I think they're from a ministry down in Georgia.
Albany, Georgia. Yeah, and they've been amazing. I thought Fireproof was terrific.
Fireproof,
they did.
I thought
Courageous was pretty good.
And one of my favorites, and it's a very hokey film.
It was Facing the Giants.
And,
that was their first big success.
Yeah, and for me, if anybody from Hollywood is listening right now, it's like, I know that's not critically acclaimed, and critics could say, well, it's very predictable. But, us folks here in middle America that go to church on a weekly basis kind of like that every so often.
What's interesting about that is the star, a very pretty star, for instance, of Fireproof, is a daughter of one of the pastors. And this is all done by the same church. It's a large church in Albany, Georgia, and more power to them. There was another film like that was actually made by Roman Catholics called The Spitfire Grill, which was also a very values-rich movie with Ellen Burstyn and did spectacularly well. There is an audience for this sort of thing, and you don't need that large an audience to do exceptionally well. On a completely different topic, my friend Dinesh D'Souza made a movie called 2016, which was basically attacking President Obama. That is now the second top-grossing documentary ever.
Wow, underneath a Michael Moore one, I
correct?
Assume, right?
Yes, yeah. But still, and frankly, the film was okay. I thought it was interesting. I don't think it was a great or epic-making film, but the audience out there is not represented by the people on the Upper West Side of New York or the West Side of Los Angeles, who are the people that all the folks in the industry actually know.
Yeah, let me talk a little bit about the people in the industry, because we're talking about films, but one of the other factors in our modern American life is not only do we like the stars that are up there on the silver screen, we like to follow them in their regular lives. And Hollywood has a reputation of individuals being filled with very decadent behavior, to say the least. And I've always been curious about why that is, and if that affects what we see on the screen as well. And if you mentioned there's more religious people coming out, is there any sense that is changing? Let me just throw a hypothesis out at you, because I always wondered why stars always get into trouble that they do. And it just seems to me it's the nature of the acting business, that you have to go in front of a lot of strangers and lose all your inhibitions in the process of acting. And that just seems to translate over into your regular life. Once you do that in front of a camera, why not act like an idiot on, Sunset Boulevard on some evening? Is that the culture that's there?
I think it goes beyond even acting. It's okay. the general idea of artistry. And by the way, one of the things that I've talked about for years is I think it was a disaster when people decided that they were no longer in the entertainment business. I like the idea entertainment business, because business, you provide people with a product. One hopes like the product, they buy more of it. And basically, that was the way they used to run the old studios. And the people who ran the old studios were not saints by any means. They were, in some cases, pretty nasty guys and people with troubled personal lives. However, they understood that there was an audience out there for more wholesomeness. And all of a sudden, when the movie business became, well, we're now artists, that's the end of it. I mean, because basically and this has also been part of modernity. The the idea of the suffering artist, the artist who is going to assault bourgeois convention, who is at the margins of society, that's very, very deep in the 20th century. And certainly in the 21st century it is as well. And the one thing that I like to mention to people is, sure, there are all kinds of people. Shakespeare, we don't know anything about his personal life, but it was probably pretty bad. I mean, he left his wife, Anne Hathaway, who was 16 years older than him, behind in Stratford, and he comes to London. Who knows what he was doing? There's always been people in theater who have lived on the fringe. But there also used to be the ideal of the good bourgeois, hardworking artist, the respectable. I mean, Alfred Lord Tennyson was poet laureate, and Dickens. Yes, Dickens had a scandalous affair at the end of his life after 10 children, but I kept that a secret. And he was basically a hardworking guy who tried to send, as he did in Christmas Carol, affirmative messages to the public. And So I think that this whole idea that in order to be a great artist, you have to be someone who is drunk or does drugs or has many different women, a lot of this goes back to some of the notions in early modernity, but then also in the 60s when all of that infected popular culture. You may remember that old-time Hollywood people didn't have such great personal lives in many cases, but the studios were at great lengths to keep that a secret. People didn't know that Rock Hudson was flamboyantly gay, for instance. And do I think it's better for society now that we find out every single arrest of Lindsay Lohan, which can keep you busy for a long time? Or probably not. And it's not just because part of what happens with the entertainment industry in general, particularly with television, is it defines normal for people.
Right.
And the worst impact of all of this stuff is that for our children, it is defined normal as dysfunctional. In other words, and dysfunctional as normal. And the truth is, as you and I well know, outside the university and outside the entertainment industry, there are a lot of Americans who lead good, solid, honorable, religious, middle-class lives, work hard, pay our taxes, try to raise our children, try to promote decent values. And that America is almost never portrayed on film. It's never portrayed on TV. It's never portrayed. It's just the invisible America. It's the silent majority.
Well, with the few minutes we have remaining here, I want to return to that question that you raised in the 10 Big Lies About America about our irreversible moral decline, which you say is not happening. But what we've just been talking about here leads me down a rather pessimistic path. And there's the question that comes up, yes, middle America is normal. They want to lead wholesome lives. They flock to movies like The Blind Side and want to be inspired in films. Yet we see dysfunction all the time on the television and on the big screen and in our tabloid newspapers. What does the future look like? Is normal America winning, or maybe are we just going to throw up our hands and have dysfunctional America?
Well, this is a very big question and one that can't be properly really addressed in a I'll make some effort at addressing
it. It's actually a true or false question, but yeah.
Right. The basic thing is the nature of technological change has been both a blessing and a curse. Is that the great thing about the old Hollywood was they could get together and enforce something like the old production code, because there were only 8 companies in town. They were family-owned businesses. All these people knew each other. And the production code was never imposed by government, thank God. It was an agreement of the people who ran the 8 big studios that, okay, we control what gets shown in America. And by the way, until an antitrust action after the war, most of the big movie companies owned their own theaters. And they had vertical integration, as it was called. In other words, there was a Fox Theater in every town. There was a Paramount Theater in every town. This was a normal thing. And then you could determine what gets shown. we now have the extreme opposite of that, where there are so many sources of entertainment. It's on the internet. There are, what, 116 major cable networks in the country. Just unimaginable. You and I both can remember when there were only three stations on TV, even in big cities, and maybe one independent.
You got your PBS station and public access and the three big networks, yeah.
Right, and that would be basically it. And now there's so much stuff. Now, it's a blessing because if you look for it today, and this never used to be the case, at any hour of day or night, you can find something that's worth watching on some cable network somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
It exists. I mean, sometimes it's on the History Channel. Sometimes it'll be performance.
In between Pawn Stars and Ice Road Truckers, you can find history occasionally there. Yep.
Right. But but at the same time, the access to pornography is so much greater. So basically, if one believes that God is working in American history, and I believe that God has worked in every stage of American history, what he's saying to the American people is, okay, you choose. I set before you this day life and death, blessing and curse. Therefore, choose life. And choosing life for Americans has to mean turning off the TV a little bit more. I mean, the one statistic, because basically, if you actually look at the United States, by most measures, we are much better off than we were in the 70s and 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Divorce rate is lower. Drug addiction, much lower.
Crime
dramatically
is lower.
Yeah. Crime is vastly lower. Alcoholism, lower. Traffic accidents per capita, the lowest level since, I think, 1920, when cars were still not all that common. Lots of things in the United States have been going right. The one thing that has not been going right is the amount of time that we spend in front of screens. And long term, this is going to have a very damaging effect. It has to. And there are all kinds of physiological investigations of this. There's all tremendous research at how bad it is for you, how bad it is for kids. We've always been a TV-free household. I left my parents' home. I started college when I was 16. And when I went to school, they didn't permit TV, and nowhere in the dormitories. So I went cold turkey, having grown up TV addicted. And I'm not suggesting that everybody should have junk your TV, but turn it off once in a while. And one of the points that I think is a tremendous starting place for people is one of the things. There are a lot of things that Christians do better than Jews, and there's one big thing that we do better than Christians, which is the Sabbath. It's the fourth commandment of the Big Ten. I guess it's the fifth commandment if you count the Catholic way. Or is it the third? I forget. I know the Catholics count it differently. But in any event, the Sabbath commandment is confusing to a lot of Christians because does the Lord really mean Sunday or Saturday? And what does it mean to honor the Sabbath day and keep it holy? One way to honor the Sabbath day and keep it holy is turn off the TV.
Spend time with the family.
Exactly. Yeah. And by the way, you have the added benefit of not having to watch the Seahawks lose. but it is peculiar because, you know, if you go to church and then you have a Sunday dinner and then you're going to turn on the TV to watch football or something else, it's kind of defeating the purpose because it's not that everything on TV, as I've said, it's not everything is dirt and filth and excrement. It's not. There's some good stuff. But none of it is real life. And real life, which we all have a limited store of, involves conversation and love and sharing and community and family. And none of that do you get by plopping yourself together with people in front of moving shadows on a cathode ray tube.
Well, I like what you said about how God's hand is working through America through providence, and I really resonate with that, and I oftentimes think of these cultural challenges that us religious folks like to complain about as just that. They're challenges for us to overcome, and it's whenever
we've done it before. Yeah. I mean, one of the things I write about in my book, in 10 Big Lies About America, is we've had three great awakenings that have all had great consequence to this country. Part of the second great awakening in this country was ending slavery. It was very much gave birth to the abolition movement. You think about overcoming a challenge. I mean, you think about a big chunk of this country validated the idea that people could be treated as property. It's an obscene idea. And you talk about an idea, a total variance with the Christian or Judeo-Christian view of human beings. It was, and we overcame that. One of the things that's fascinating to me, people used to have a much bigger problem with drinking in this country. Now you could say, well, it's been replaced by pot, but probably if the level of drinking was such a huge problem in the colonial era. And it was one of those things that was dealt with by the Second Great Awakening and the explosion of religious fervor in the 1830s and 40s. And then at the turn of the century, we had another one. There, the moral statistics of illegitimate children, of parentless children, just abandoned children, broken marriages, in the 1880s and 90s. Was quite terrible, and then you had the beginnings of Pentecostalism and the Azusa Street revival, and then this huge explosion of religious energy, and it redeemed the country. I used to be convinced that we were in the midst of a fourth Great Awakening. The first one was the one with Jonathan Edwards in the 1740s, 50s. But I'm not so sure we're in the midst yet, maybe still at the early stages, but it's something the country desperately needs. And this is not, this is ecumenical. I mean, I don't think there's any question. From a Jewish perspective, there really is only one long-term hope for the United States, which is a Christian revival. and a more Christian America is emphatically good for the Jews.
Mm-hmm. I think that is an interesting challenge to leave off on, some interesting thoughts. And so, Michael, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion. And I have to say this, on God's... I forgot to say it. You say it.
Yes. Well, it is great to have this kind of conversation as part of the effort to sustain, nourish, and glorify this greatest nation on God's green earth.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.